Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you again. Kind of been on an Emerson kick lately, so our words this morning come to us from Ralph Waldo. In our life and culture, everything is worked up and comes in use. Passion, war, revolt, bankruptcy, and not less, folly and blunders, insult, ennui, and bad company. Nature is a rag merchant who works up every shred and end into new creations, like a good chemist, whom I found the other day in his laboratory, converting his old shirts into pure sugar. Life is a boundless privilege, and when you pay for your ticket and get into the car, you have no guess what good company you shall find there. You buy much that is not rendered in the bill. We achieve a certain greatness unawares while working to another aim. So by way of introduction, I'd like to say that my goal in speaking on the topic of the personal and the political comes from a place of curiosity, and I hope a spirit of mutual inquiry. And although my social location, straight, white, male, and a minister, is traditionally one of privilege and authority, I don't claim to have answers. Only one perspective out of the many in this room. And to what degree that location biases my perception and my perspective, I leave up to you. Being good Unitarian Universalists, I'm sure none of you will take my words as gospel simply because of where I stand. Or at least I hope not. If so, let's talk. And sometimes when I start out reading and writing for a sermon, I end up in a place I didn't expect. And this is one of those times. Politics don't exist in a bubble. Politics and the policies born from it and the ideals it exposes are deeply intertwined with everything in our lives. And it's almost impossible to separate ourselves from politics and its consequences. And the reality is that politics are very personal. Who we support politically reveals what we value and how we think. Do you value individualism or collectivism? Is healthcare a right or a privilege? Should refugees be denied entry into America or welcome? Ban guns or more guns? And that list of questions goes on, but most of them are framed as binaries. They're either or, they're yes or no. And that leads me to wonder, and I hope us to wonder, where did the nuance go? Why did we end up with these choices? Can I think that individualism is good in some cases and collectivism is better than others? Better in others? Can some refugees be welcome and others denied entry? How did we end up here in this place of such polarization? How did everything get so politicized? There isn't anything wrong with living a political life, as Sonny Bunch argued in the Washington Free Beacon in 2013. Politics is important. Political decisions have consequences, and passionately arguing for your preferred political outcomes is nothing to be ashamed of, he wrote. But a politicized life is a different beast, however. It treats politics as a zero-sum game or a form of total warfare in which the other side must be obliterated. It alters every aspect of your being, where you shop, what you watch on TV or listen to on the radio, what sort of music you listen to, and who you associate with. If you're not with the politicized being, you're against him. And if you're against him, he is well within his rights to ruin you personally and economically. You, the political other, are a leper to be shunned. Wow, that's pretty ugly. Now, to one degree or another, many of us remember, or not, the political and social ferment of the 1960s. The civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, the rise of the new left, the sexual revolution, the political awakening of all kinds of people and classes, Black Power and the Black Panthers, La Raza and La Causa, the Gray Panthers, second wave feminism, environmentalism, gay liberation, the drugs, and the music. It was popularly called the counterculture, and the drugs and the music got a lot of attention. Well, the drugs and the music have more or less faded into history, but the social and political conflicts it started are still being played out today. One of the most influential concepts on the left came out of the feminist movement. Carol Hanisch, a member of the New York Radical Women and a prominent figure in the women's liberation movement, drafted an article defending the political importance of women's consciousness-raising groups in February 1969 in Gainesville, Florida. And in that essay, she challenged the idea that sex and appearance, abortion, child care, and the division of household labor were merely personal issues without political importance. To confront these and other issues, she urged women to overcome self-blame, discuss their situations amongst each other, and organize collectively against male domination of society. In her essay, she wrote this: "One of the first things we discover in these groups is that personal problems are political problems. There are no personal solutions at this time. There is only collective action for a collective solution." And it's from that phrase that the personal is political came about. And this opened up what were considered private or social matters to political analysis and discussion. And it reveals the systemic nature of oppression. As summarized by Heidi Hartman, who wrote, "Women's discontent, radical feminists argued, is not the neurotic lament of the maladjusted, but a response to a social structure in which women are systematically dominated, exploited, and oppressed." And more broadly, as civil rights activist and critical race scholar Kimberly Williams Crenshaw observes, this process of recognizing as social and systemic what was formerly perceived as isolated and individual has also characterized the identity politics of African Americans, other people of color, gays and lesbians, among others. And this critical understanding of the systemic nature of many forms of oppression is one of the most enduring analytical legacies of that era. Following on Carol Hanisch's insight, Paula Rust argued that one should make personal choices that are consistent with one's personal politics. Personal life and personal politics are indistinguishable. And that's when things got problematic. Because there are real dangers in politicizing the private sphere, the arena of personal choice and individual freedom. And there was the very real danger of thinking that our personal choices could actually change anything. But despite these critiques, the various liberation movements picked this up and ran with it. And in doing so, the private and public boundary disintegrated. And the distinctions between ethics, the ought to in the personal realm, and politics, the ought to in the public realm, collapsed. And it could be argued that this erasing of boundaries caused the tribal polarization that has plagued our political process ever since. So let's back up a minute, talk about the counterculture, the other counterculture. Several observers have made note of the fact that after the breakdown of the rational, systemic, post-World War II consensus, social order, started to break down in the 1950s, two different countercultures emerged. One has been called the Aquarians, and I described it earlier. And the other, what some have called a counterculture, emerged from the unification of the political right with evangelical Christianity. Both countercultures offered a new alternative, a universalist, absolutist, anti-rational system to replace the failing social order. They both explicitly rejected rationality, which had been a foundation of the previous system. Rationality had failed them. Rationality was the cause of all the evils of the 20th century, the world wars, the loss of Christian faith, rampant materialism, ecological devastation, abortion, nuclear weapons, the oppressive state, the breakdown of the social order, you name it. They were both absolutist, taking the stance that sees the meaning of everything as measured against a fixed eternal principle, such as God, or some cosmic plan, or a political theory like Marxism. And they were universalist, not in the sense that we use it, because they were making the claim that what is right for everyone, everywhere. Both proposed universalist alternatives to the post-war order. The Aquarians, so that everyone should question authority, do what feels good, study war no more. The evangelicals said that everyone should obey authority, save it for marriage, and pledge allegiance to the flag. And that's a gross generalization, say the least. But it holds a kernel of truth, which is that these conflicting cultural visions were mirror images of each other. And this idea that one should make personal choices that are consistent with one's personal politics, and that personal life and personal politics are indistinguishable, was applied just as easily by the evangelicals to their politics. Still with me?
Yep.
It's important to note that these were essentially spiritual movements, driven by spiritual needs that ended up being absorbed into the two parties of the American political system. They were also led by white men. Mostly. These countercultures redefined the American left and right, redefined their political positions from policy stances to values ideologies. And so the Democratic and Republican parties repositioned themselves as champions of opposing cultural values. And politics shifted from arguments about pragmatic policy questions to tribal battles and virtue signaling. And this has polarized American politics in such a way that it may not be resolvable. We are deadlocked right now. Politics is supposed to be the way to deal with vast problems and impending catastrophes, and it's totally dysfunctional and it is not working, particularly at the national level. It has become the problem, not the solution. So earlier I asked, where did the nuance go? Why did we end up with these political choices? And how did we arrive at this impasse? Sometimes we need to take a back, step back, move a little in one direction or the other, and take a look from a different perspective. The universalism of the countercultures was their fatal flaw. Because no single system of meaning can work for everyone, or even for most people. Both countercultural visions have failed to appeal to a majority. People are complex, and they make complex choices about who they are and what they do, and they pick from one here and one there, and they do what works for them so they can survive and live their lives, hopefully in peace. So they make these complex choices. They blur the lines and boundaries, and most of them have opted out of the culture war, even as it wreaks havoc around them. The culture war blocks sensible solutions to urgent and important social, economic, and practical problems. So why does it persist? And here's where I had to bite the bullet. I had to listen to the next generation. I ran across this commentary from a Gen Xer, and it really caused me to take another look at my beliefs, where I stand. David Chapman wrote, "The culture war persists largely because most baby boomers do not understand why their countercultures failed." Although the countercultures have been over for a quarter century, participants on both sides do not accept this obvious fact and are unwilling to draw any conclusions from it. This is the part that really hit home here. Many participants have a wistful certainty that someday, somehow, the glorious counterculture of their youth will rise again, and its eternal truth and justice will triumphantly replace the corrupt mainstream. They maintain a rosy nostalgia for the hippie or Reagan eras. They cherish salvation fantasies for the future after the revolution, or when we make America great again. And this is entirely unrealistic on both sides. And both sides resent the other as the apparent explanation for their own counterculture's failure. I suspect one reason the culture war has heated up dramatically in the past few years is that baby boomers realize they will pass out of public life over the next decade, and now is their last chance to impose their values on everyone else. It's a final desperate push before their time runs out. And realizing that victory is unlikely within their lifetime accounts for some of the bitterness of the war. This is a hard but fascinating insight. I take it to heart. I'm a baby boomer. To what degree am I responsible, guilty of perpetuating this? And the generation governing this country is the boomers. And many of them are still fighting the battles of their youth, trying to impose their values and vision on the whole country, many of whom don't want either side's version, and have grown disgusted with the dysfunction and the righteousness and the hypocrisy of the parties. And the reality is that there hasn't been a mainstream America for decades. America is a balkanized patchwork of subcultures and economic, social, ethnic, and regional interests. Any victory by either side is apt to be temporary and ignored. And although the evangelical right is on track to gain more power and impose their values through law, that won't last. Aquarian cultural practices are too widespread. Americans are too diverse and too fractious. And as everyone knows, the multicultural, multiracial, multi-faith future is coming. And that will be way more complicated than anyone expects on either side of the divide. I think a real and very pressing question is not which side you are on or who wins, but how do we stop this fruitless culture war? Move ahead. Because the culture war is a zero-sum game. Because nothing is going to get done until the war is over, until one side wins, or more likely, there is nothing to left to fight over but the wreckage of a country. Or what else? Are there alternatives? Or are we locked in combat like a pair of stags who get their horns so tangled up they die of starvation, unable to disengage? So imagine with me for a minute what it would be like to just stop being so partisan, to depoliticize people, to relax and de-escalate, to restore some reasonable boundaries between the personal and the political, that not everything we say, do, think, wear, eat is some kind of political act. Now, if politics, which is to say power, was my main game, I might not be interested in that. Too many interests benefit from this war, and they don't care about the results, only about their personal and political gain. But that isn't my interest. I have this perhaps naive, radical idea that as people of faith, as religious people, our main job is to stop the war before more beings get hurt. And because there is so much more pressing business we need to attend to. Now, I don't even know that's possible. I may be dreaming wildly. This may have gone on too far too long for the stags to disengage their horns. But I have a sneaking suspicion that whoever stops it will end up having the most influence on the future. Anyway, that's where I ended up this time. Raises a lot of questions for me as a human being, as an American. And I'm curious to hear what you think. Because, like I say, I just have one perspective. And we all need each other. So, thank you for listening.